Retronauts is part of the HyperX Podcast Network. Find us and more great shows at podcast.hyperx.com. Hey everybody, it's Bob Mackey up at the top with a little disclaimer, just to let everyone know out there, our guest Chris Cabin, his audio is a bit choppy for the first 20 minutes of the podcast, but after that, it clears up and he sounds fine, just in case you're wondering. We apologize for the tech issue, and we hope you enjoy the podcast. This week on Retronauts, the President's Egg is missing. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and today's episode is all about John Carpenter's 1981 film, Escape from New York. It's been a long time coming because this action thriller has had a huge impact on video games, one series in particular, but I think it kind of predicted what every video game would be maybe 20 years later. Before I continue any further, who is here with me today in the same room?
It's Henry Gilbert, and I'm rocking out to American Bandstand right now.
It's the tune of 1997. We're all listening to it in on our singles, I think. And who do we have on the line? Special guest, first-time guest to Retronauts.
Chris Cabin, Duke A number one.
That's right, and Chris Cabin is from We Hate Movies. You might have heard him on that podcast or perhaps on Talking Simpsons, but I brought him on here for his movie expertise. And in fact, you and your crew did a podcast about this movie, We Love Movies, back in April of 2021. I heartily recommend checking that out, too, if you like our discussion, because that's a great discussion by four guys who really love this movie. And that's why Chris is here today, obviously.
Oh, yeah. And I'm glad that you remembered when it came out, because it's just all been a wash now for me. It happened sometime in the past. I know that for sure.
Yeah, we're heading.
It's a movie I love a lot.
We're heading into like year three of COVID, and I think I've recorded 1,000 podcasts since the beginning. So it is just a gray blur. But the information is out there if you're curious as to what happened on which days. But before I continue, yeah. I want to ask everybody on the podcast, what is your experience with John Carpenter and this movie in particular? Chris, you're the newest guest to our show. Where did you find John Carpenter, and what is your experience with this movie and his work?
Well, Carpenter came to me, I think I was late horror in general. I had seen bits of Starman on TV. That's how I knew about Jeff Bridges. But the horror stuff didn't kick until college, really. I think I had seen a certain, like, I'd seen The Exorcist. Everybody tells you to see The Exorcist. Carpenter came at like second year, and I watched The Thing, and I was overwhelmed, like genuinely overwhelmed. That's my feeling with that movie. Only other movie I really feel that way about is Texas Chainsaw. Once you see his movies, you get a sense of the personality that's behind it, and it's very rare that the movies express and so succinctly.
That's
and
true. Yeah.
I think his movies really do succinctly express who he is as a person, how he thinks politically, how he thinks, what he thinks about society, romance, mating, all a wash of things, culture especially. That's something that comes from a tradition of B movies. That's what connected me to immediately was being of the having been dipped in Sam Fuller, having been dipped in Howard Hawks and all that stuff. And he was a guy who made movies about workers, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal workers a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Workers nonetheless. It just immediately struck with me. Immediately. I was like, this is a guy.
And Henry, how about you?
I got into him in the 90s as a video store nerd. Like, I definitely did. I think the first, but this is a funny thing. I think Halloween was definitely the first thing of his I saw, probably because I had seen Scream, and Scream talks about Halloween so much that I'm like, well, I got to just see Halloween to know what the deal is. And plus then 2 years later comes out H2O Halloween water. So I'm like, oh, this is made for me. But then I also did get into the in 96. It was an interesting time because Escape from LA came out. And so I was watching E! News Network all the time, and it was advertising it quite a lot. So I was like, all right, I'm up for this. And so then over time, I started watching his other stuff. Like, I think a big thing for me in the late 90s was seeing They Live, but a cable edit of it, and which I still loved. And then when I rented the tape of it, I was like, oh my god, this is the greatest movie just for the fight scene. I love the fight scene. And then as I got older, I could recognize like the themes, especially in They Live, the themes. And on top of that, I did love that he hired like pro wrestlers, sometimes like Rowdy Roddy Piper, to be in his movies.
There's
like
one in this movie.
Yeah. And on top of that, like to find a muse in Kurt Russell, and Kurt Russell is so great. And when I see Kurt Russell appear in like Tarantino movies and he's great there, I'm just thinking like, well, he's just, you know, being the carpenter guy he is. Like, he's just such an interesting character. Like, there's lots of good Carpenter movies that don't have Kurt Russell in it, but when it's the two of them together, mm-hmm. like, that is about as good as it gets. And yeah, same with another of my all-time favorites is Big Trouble in Little China. I think it's, like, one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. Hmm. And Escape from New York, yeah, I, as then a gamer, over time, I came to realize how, oh, that snake guy in a video game has some striking similarities.
Legally distinct.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe. But yeah, as for me, actually, I didn't really get into John Carpenter until my late 20s, early 30s. So about a decade ago, because when I was a teen and getting into movies, he was only making bad movies. It was the 90s were a really rough decade for him. He barely lasted in the 2000s. So I thought, like, why do I want to see what this guy made before? Mm-hmm. He seems pretty bad. And in the discussions of like, oh, what are the cool 80s movies to see, like Terminator and Repo Man, this movie never came up, weirdly enough. So finally, like in my late 20s, I was like, all right, I finally should get into Carpenter. And I watched all of them, all the good ones, except for this one. And I saved it for this year because I thought my love of Metal Gear Solid would make this movie too distracting. I was like, I realize how much was borrowed from this. I'm just going to be thinking about that the whole time. And if you're thinking that like I did, you're wrong, because it stands on its own. But it's also very, very funny to see just how inspired Hideo Kojima was to make his own version of this movie in video game form. But yeah, it took me a long time to come around to John Carpenter, but I love all of his 80s stuff. I'm sorry, you guys, I don't like Big Trouble in Little China. Aww. I tried to like it, but I don't like it. But I think The Thing is like one of the top 10 movies of all time. It's so, so good. But oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad I finally came around to enjoying John Carpenter, and this movie especially. I don't know if it's underrated or properly rated, but it still doesn't come up as often as his other big 80s movies.
I think this one, for me at least, is very properly rated. It's in my top 10, but it's in my top 5 for him. What's interesting about him in general is that he has this chip on his shoulder that I think a lot of directors tend to get at his age, but he seems to be the only one who genuinely has earned it.
Like, yeah.
Can you think of someone who has made a movie as resoundingly beloved as The Thing that the critics just absolutely did not get? Like, at all. Resoundingly did not understand when it was really, like, they painted that movie like it was one of the worst films ever made. And now it is by all means considered an American classic. Like, and I think a lot of his films have been, it's been the last 10 years that Carpenter has really come up as this a distinctly American auteur. Escape from New York is one of those movies where I think it's always discussed, but because it hasn't been through the remake machine, urgency. The way that discussions about Halloween do and discussions about The Thing do, mm-hmm. because those have been through the hill already.
Yeah, it's shocking to go back and read reviews of Carpenter movies. It's kind of like going back to read reviews of like season 4 Simpsons episodes on newsgroups saying, oh yeah, Mr. Plow, the worst episode yet. This episode is too crazy. Right. They lost the heart. And you're thinking, Pearls Before Swine, you had no idea how good you had it with him. And yeah, you mentioned like this has not been through the remake or reboot machine. A lot of Carpenter stuff has. This hasn't. And there were so many like big plans for the Snake Plissken verse that I think thankfully didn't pan out. We'll talk more about that later once we talk about the movie itself.
Yeah, I think something that really changed for Carpenter over time was, you know, in the 70s, his genre stuff really wasn't appreciated much. And into the 80s. Not really appreciated much by critics. And then the generation that grew up with his films could then, you know, talk up how great he was and what a, you know, auteur, like he letting his films be called John Carpenter's possessive S films, like that was a big deal. Like it let him put his stamp on those movies. And it also let you know that when they remade something or did like the 17th version of Halloween, it's like, well, it's not really John Carpenter. Like he took a paycheck, but this isn't his movie like that. By the way, I watched that Movies That Made Us documentary thing on Netflix, which I have an iffy relationship with, but it does do the research. The funniest one is the Halloween one because it gets everybody but Carpenter. Huh. And so the executive producer is like, you know, actually, that was my idea. And I was the one who said he should do a thing set at Halloween. I was like, sure. Yeah.
I guess they weren't going to pay him to show up or at least feed him. Mm-hmm. I think Carpenter, I mean, he's like a pro worker, obviously. Look at the stance of his movies. He wants to be paid for whatever he's doing.
Well, how many times has he been interviewed of like, so what was the making of Halloween? Like, he's like, he could probably just say like, I've said this in 5 other movies.
Yeah.
Just get clips from that and then use it there.
And he also would say, you know, it sucked. I hated doing everything. Yeah, let's talk about John Carpenter and his career. Just, I mean, this is a 90-minute podcast. In case you don't know who he is or where he came from, his career basically began in the mid-70s with 2 very different movies. So we have Dark Star, which is a sci-fi comedy, and we have Assault on Precinct 13, which is a thriller-slash-exploitation movie. Both of these are made for very little money. Carpenter is wearing a lot of hats. He's directing. He's writing the screenplays. He's writing the music. He did plenty of collaboration later, but he's kind of like a one-man band for a lot of this stuff early in his career. And because of that, he's able to make movies for very cheap, and even a modest hit is a major hit. Assault on Precinct 13 especially, I think that's kind of what put him on the map in terms of like critical appraisal and in terms of making a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's one of those movies you see it and you can't forget it. I can't even imagine what I would have thought seeing that when it actually was released. It's shocking. Some of the images in that movie are genuinely shocking to this day. And he goes from that. I mean, like, the thing about him is that he was surrounded by a bunch of guys. Like, it was the dream team, right? It was like the same guys who worked on Star Wars or who were in that orbit were in this area. And you just had this like, nexus of creative energy going on
right
between these guys.
Yeah, it wasn't.
And Dark Star, I think, is the first bloom of that.
Well, right. And the writer of Alien wrote Dark Star with him, like, too, right? Like, it's kind of
so,
like
yeah.
A proto-Alien as well, yeah.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, we'll talk more about it when we talk about the making of the movie, but, I mean, James Cameron is working on Escape from New York, and so is Dean Cundey, the legendary cinematographer. Like, he is doing a lot on his own, but he's lucky to have access to just this incredible group of young, talented filmmakers with him.
Yeah, and Not to be an old man complaining about current cinema, but something I like about even his earliest stuff with Assault on Precinct 13, like, you can tell so much that John Carpenter grew up loving the cowboy movies of his youth.
Mm-hmm.
But because Hollywood was different then, he didn't just remake all of the cowboy movies he watched as a kid, like in name and even with the same old actors. It's like Rio Bravo, The Next Generation. Like, he didn't do that. He took that love and then recontextualized it for a new story in a different genre.
Kurt Russell, can you imitate Clint Eastwood?
Yeah.
Sure.
No, I mean, he's like, yeah, Jack Burton is John Wayne in Escape. The Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah. So, yeah, we have Dark Star, 74, Assault on Precinct 13, 76. Then we have 1978's Halloween. You should know what Halloween is. It's been rebooted 4 times. There's a new trilogy out. But again, another mercenary production. Yeah. He was just having fun, but he just like transcended the horror genre. He sort of established the slasher genre. There were slasher exploitation movies like 15 to 20 years before this movie, mm-hmm. but he sort of just like reestablished it. It was just this huge success, made for no money, written in 10 days, I think, filmed in maybe 4 weeks. And after this, his movies are now called John Carpenter's blank.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it, yes, it kind of invents the slasher genre. I mean, you know, Texas Chainsaw comes before it, but the, you know, this could happen on your block kind of thing, and the punishment for sex as well, like all of these, mm-hmm, all of the rules that Jamie Kennedy so expertly explains in the Scream movies, they're set up in this. Also in that doc, a compliment I'll give it to is that they talked to Nick Castle, the who's, you know, a friend of his and was Mike Myers in the first movie, and they talk a lot about Deborah Hill, his producing partner and partner in life, that who doesn't get as much credit in histories of Carpenter's work. So that was a cool thing.
Yeah, I feel like the reevaluation has also come with giving more credit to Deborah Hill for her, like, this last round. I mean, it all came with, like, I think the thing that really did it all was Get Out being, like, such a humongous deal, and horror finally coming back as, like, this is an American genre that's still alive and still putting out original work as of today. Not as of 20 years ago. Today, it's still happening.
I think it was the one time in the last decade where the Oscars deigned to nominate any horror movie for anything. Was Get Out best screenplay?
Yeah.
Best screenplay? I think so. Won.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it is.
I mean, it's insane to have that work. Like Deborah Hill's work on all this stuff, it should definitely have been... we should have been talking about her in the 90s. We should have been talking about her in the 80s. And she was it wasn't like she wasn't working, but, like, that was all part of this recontextualization that was happening about credit, who was going to get credit from movies. Like, a certain, I don't know if you want to call it a taking down, but a reevaluation of auteur and, like, what exactly, who are you going to give the credit to and why?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with Halloween is just, it proved that you make a lot of money on a slasher.
Yeah. It was a phenomenon. I guess you had to be there. Obviously, we were all too young to have even been alive when the movie came out, but it was just a huge phenomenon. It was a must-see movie. And yeah, Deborah Hill that you brought up, Chris, I think she passed away in, like, 2004, but she started working with Carpenter on, I believe, Assault on Precinct 13, and was a big part of his early 80s movies, just a big collaborator with him. So, yeah, we're up to Halloween in 78, and then we have The Fog, which is the first John Carpenter's blank. So John Carpenter's The Fog. And then he does, before that, a few more TV movies. So he does Someone's Watching Me, and that's where he meets Adrienne Barbeau, and they briefly are married. And then he does Elvis, which was, I think at the time, the highest rated TV movie of all time. I have not seen it. Kurt Russell is playing Elvis. That's where he meets Kurt Russell. And so he's assembling, like, a cast of players he'll be using at least throughout the 80s.
It's a funny thing to remember with Kurt Russell is that he was the Zendaya of his day. He was a Disney kid who then moved into real movies. Like, it was he was on that path just as much as Hilary Duff was before, too. Like, this, the, or Britney Spears, like the Disney children who are trained and kind of manufactured at Disney, then come into their own as actors. And that gives Kurt Russell, like, a Hollywood royalty kind of vibe while starring in gritty movies. Like, I think that adds extra punch to seeing him in movies go, like, fuck you. Like, you're just like, whoa, the computer who wore tennis shoes is saying fuck you.
It's like watching Zac Efron go from High School Musical to doing, like, raunchy, bad, dirty grandpa comedies or whatever he does now.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kurt Russell.
Yeah, the beach bum kind of stuff.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, Kurt Russell, he was a Disney star. I think just like 6 years before that, he was doing like the Dexter whatever trilogy, which is like the computer wore tennis shoes, and the last one was like The Strongest Man in the World or something. Just these silly ass Disney movies. And I remember being a kid, and these would come on TV. They would be the longest, dreariest things in the world. You'd see the Disney logo, like, oh boy, a cartoon is coming on. No, it's 4 hours of The Happiest Millionaire. That's what's next.
Awful.
Oh,
it's real bad.
I got to say, I've never watched any of his Disney stuff. I've never seen any of it. I caught him right when he was doing the transition from being like the Disney kid. He went through this weird phase of Westerns where he was the kidnapped son. It was kind of like, a weird take on Searchers. Like, he was kidnapped by Native Americans and, like, given a new name and, like, taken in by them, and the family tries to find him. Called The Quest. They made, like, two or three of these movies.
Huh.
And then finally, he gets into this area where he tries used cars, where he's just saying, like, it's like a filthy comedy if you've ever seen it. It's Zemeckis. It's absolutely filthy. And then he does this. And then there's one more that I'm completely forgetting, another big movie. It's like a Joseph Sargent, like, do you know what America is? Like a farmer meets a model type drama.
Huh.
It's unbelievable. Anyway, but like he does, this is a moment where he chooses the next path he's going to go through. Like, used cars didn't work out for him. It was a disaster. And this does work. So all of a sudden he's like, well, this is it. This is the thing I'm going to do from now on. And it really does paint the next decade or two of his career.
Yeah, it's fun to see how versatile he is, because when I was a kid in the late 80s, early 90s, what I found Kurt Russell was in movies like Overboard and Captain Ron, those movies. Yes. That was my Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
And then he went back to action, and now he's like in a new Santa Claus trilogy for Netflix.
Yes.
He's playing right. He's a true bad Santa.
Yeah. No, I mean, he really did find a new thing with Tarantino. Like, I'm glad that they have a real kinship together, because, like, he makes that Death Proof movie great. Like, he's the core of that movie and makes it awesome. And, like, him is the hard ass in the world in Hateful Eight. He's so great in that, too. But I feel like it's Tarantino's hiring him to be the Carpenter guy that he had. Mm-hmm. Like, Tarantino obviously grew up loving John Carpenter's work so much.
So, yes, moving back to his career, we did The Fog in 80. So then Escape from New York, which we'll talk about in detail very soon. Both of these are modest hits, bring up way more than their small budgets. They're not like mega hits, but they're made for such little money relatively that they keep him in business and keep him a filmmaker. So we have some other movies. We talked about The Thing that really underperforms. Then we have Christine in 83. That's another modest hit. And then Starman underperforms in the same way The Thing did. But what really derailed his career, and it's interesting to see, like, he really just had 10 years at the top of his, like, respective mountain there. So in 86, Big Trouble in Little China, it's his biggest flop to date. It's his biggest budget to date. It makes no money. And it's funny, like, I remember seeing this on TV as a kid like a billion times. It's funny, these movies you thought were big movies as a kid weren't, just because you just see them so much. Like Labyrinth, I thought, like, everyone loves Labyrinth. No, everybody hated Labyrinth. They thought it was stupid. And the same thing with this movie too.
The Three Amigos, I saw 8
Bob,
million
this
times.
Is the first time I'm finding out that people didn't like Labyrinth. Are you serious? People didn't like Labyrinth?
Yes, in fact, I mean, if you can look at the budget and the box office on Wikipedia, but I read this, like, massive Jim Henson biography that came out in, like, 2013, and it was in the 80s, he was trying to escape the Muppets, and The Dark Crystal, just a mega flop, Labyrinth comes next, just a huge flop, he's got to come crawling back to the Muppets, because these two movies just did nothing, critically panned, nobody loved them, but then they were embraced by, I think, millennials on VHS.
Incredible.
Now that's the Labyrinth thing is so funny, because it was like he then goes after Dark Crystal. He's like, George Lucas, help me try to I want to make something a little more commercial than Dark Crystal. And it ends up being about as commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is too. I love both those movies. But yeah, it's sad.
So, yes, Big Trouble in Little China, that derails his career. So he's back to making much smaller movies, which, you know what? They're really good movies. Prince of Darkness, I think, is kind of polarizing. I really enjoyed it. And They Live, of course, we talked about it. I think it's even more relevant now than it was then. Just a great movie with fun action and just silly over-the-top antics and a wrestler doing a great job in a lead role. And then the 90s are the downfall. We're going to just skirt through this very quickly, because he starts off the 90s with just like one of two mega Chevy Chase bombs of the early 90s. So one was Nothing But Trouble, a movie I have to say my mom loves that movie. It's another movie I thought was a huge movie because my mom would quote it all the time. And she would always talk about Dan Aykroyd's penis nose and how much she thought it was disgusting. But yeah, not a good movie, not a moneymaker. And then Carpenter directs Memoirs of an Invisible Man, a movie with like really cool special effects, but a huge budget. And nobody likes it.
Invisible building in that is incredible. When the building has been like half invisibilized, it's like an office tower, and like just a parts of it. Some of the coolest things I've ever seen in a movie that I could not pay attention to for the life.
As a kid, I just remember it made me think about the idea of being invisible, which I think the movie's about the hell of being invisible. It's just like, oh, when he eats like an apple, you can see like the apple being chewed up and then it goes like down into him, but you don't see his body. It's just like these apple parts floating in the air or something like that.
Those bits I've seen separate, have always seemed neat to me because it was like answers questions a nerdy child has about like superpowers or whatever. But then, I feel like I turned on Comedy Central many times and saw bits of it. And I was like, I just can't. I wonder if I would have paid more attention without commercials, but I've never given it a shot, you know?
You could tell everybody just hates being there. It's one of those movies where Chevy Chase was still kind of a prima donna. He didn't want to, like, you know, do more than a few takes. It just a bad time for him. And then, you know, the rest of the 90s, not great. There's some things like the Village of the Damned remake. There's Ghost of Mars, which was going to be Escape from Mars. But, you know, Escape from L.A. was a major bomb. Of course, Escape from L.A. Like a famously bad movie that I think people enjoy on an ironic level now. I haven't seen that, and I feel like I need to put myself through that just because I enjoy this one so much. I got to see what the sequel's like. I know. Do you guys have opinions on that movie?
I think it's very enjoyable. I think, Henry, you were talking about seeing it in the theater. I saw it in the I saw that in theater and didn't click that it was a John Carpenter movie. And I just remember liking it, just being like, oh, that's cool. That's a lot of violence and stuff. That's all I was looking for as a teenager. But I go to it now, and it does feel like it does feel representative of his feeling of what it was like to work with Hollywood on something he didn't want to do.
Yeah.
I think it does carry that mood with it.
It's time to tap in with the HyperX Quadcast S microphone. The stunning HyperX Quadcast S features dynamic, customizable RGB lighting, a convenient tap-to-mute sensor, and four selectable polar patterns, so it can broadcast crystal clear audio, whether you're gaming, streaming, podcasting, or impressing your remote colleagues and classmates. So what are you waiting for? Join the Quad Squad and tap in today with the HyperX Quadcast S microphone.
Retronauts is part of the HyperX Podcast Network. HyperX is our sponsor and the maker of the acclaimed Quadcast and Quadcast S microphones. Quadcast USB mics look and sound amazing, and they're packed with features. With four selectable polar patterns, you'll get great sound no matter where you're recording. The included shock mount and pop filter mean you won't have to shell out extra cash for a great setup. Then there's the eye-catching LED indicator and tap-to-mute sensor, so you can tap in and tap out to stop broadcast accidents. It's time for you to tap in with the HyperX Quadcast and Quadcast S.
No, I mean, it's so venomous towards Hollywood, which, like, this movie is about, like, oh, New York is a crime-ridden hellhole, whatever. And so, like, then the response, this movie is about how, like, Los Angeles is, like, the most vapid, empty place in the world. And it's where, like, humanity goes to die, all that stuff. But I think I remember thinking it was way too corny and thinking like that Escape from New York was so much better because it was really serious. I think it is too jokey, like he's having a little too much fun. And it does feel like a sketch movie, really, like how certainly events in this movie feel like, well, now he's at this like levels
it's a level
of the video
game.
Like, well, he finished that level. Now he's on to the next level. But Escape from L.A. felt even more segmented, like a group of sketches, yeah.
So, yeah, 2001 is Ghost of Mars. He kind of, I mean, he's doing creative stuff, but not filmmaking necessarily. Some TV stuff here and there. 2010, he comes back with The Ward, which everybody hates as well. So, since then, he's kind of just been like, yeah, I'll collect a check from a thing you want to remake with my name on it. I'll write music for the new Halloween trilogy. But, yeah, making movies is a lot of work, and I don't want to do it anymore. And I'm happy watching basketball and playing video games and tweeting about Halo. Mm-hmm. And that's where he is now.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be his main thing. Although I will say he has like taken me, he has wanted to make more movies. It's not like he's like completely out of the game. It's that he's asked for the budgets that would be what Carpenter at this age and this level of skill would be asking for, and they're like, we don't want to do that. Like, and it's not like franchise stuff. He wants to do like his old scripts or the El Diablo project he's always tried to make. You know, I think that's probably more of the thing, is like, it's not worth it for him to make a movie he doesn't really want to make now.
Mm-hmm. When he only has so many days left in his life, like, I can see, you know, there's only of elderly filmmakers, you know, only so many get to be, you know, Martin Scorsese or Clint Eastwood or
Ridley Scott,
Woody Allen, even. I hate to say his name, but he gets to make whatever movie he feels like.
It's hilarious because
he's still making them.
And Clint Eastwood is like, he's got like 20 years on John Carpenter.
He's so fun. No, I mean, I think that's why he makes a movie every year, because if he were to stop making movies, like, his body would like shut down. It'd be like, that's when time would catch up to the man with no name.
He's a fun guy on Twitter. Please follow him. I think it's called like the Horror Master on Twitter. He's easy to find on Twitter, but he's usually tweeting about basketball games or new like merch based on his movies, or what he's playing, like Assassin's Creed or
Halo.
He's
a real gamer, that guy.
That's
what I love about him. He's at the website Giant Bomb for years. They would get him to give like his top 10 games of the year list, and it usually would be like, you know, like 60 words or something, but that's I just want to know what he's been playing.
It shows that he played at least 10 games in a year, and I don't really know where his gaming interest started, how far back it started, but people started noticing in the 2010s that he was a gamer. So I don't know if he was when Escape from New York was released. I mean, when this movie came out, games were very primitive. I mean, this movie came out the same year as Donkey Kong, games were not as sophisticated as they are now. Like, Donkey Kong is kind of the first game with a beginning to end story, almost.
I imagine he got into gaming around the same time that his influence was starting to be felt. Like, I the early aughts feels like where he started really entering the fray.
And we'll talk about it, but there was a prospective Escape from New York video game that he had some slight involvement in, so maybe that is what got him into games. Like, I should try these games out. They seem pretty cool, and maybe that's how he became a gamer. All speculation, of course.
But as he's making fewer films, that gives him more time to game.
Yeah, I mean, all games are like 1,000 hours now. You can't be a filmmaker and play a video game. Let's talk about Escape from New York, just production details about this and, you know, how it came into being. So Carpenter, he wrote this movie before he wrote Halloween. This movie is sort of his cynical reaction to Watergate and the extremely bad politics on display. I assume it's also inspired by, you know, the wind down from Vietnam, because in this movie, Snake is a veteran, not treated very well. We don't really like veterans in this country. You know, once we put him through the meat grinder, it's like, get out of here. Go to your hospital or whatever.
We don't want to hear about our failures. Please stop. Please stop.
And you better not stop us from setting off fireworks, because we love fireworks. And also, we've got Watergate. We've got the Vietnam War. You know what? This is a weird inspiration, but it makes sense. He's inspired by Death Wish, not for the politics, but for the idea of, like, New York is just an urban jungle where there's a murderer around every corner. Mm. And, in fact, this is funny that he had Death Wish on the mind, and the financiers behind this movie wanted Charles Bronson to play Snake, apparently. They wanted a more older seasoned actor. That would have been a very different movie.
Yeah.
A bad movie, I think. I think it would have probably been a bad movie.
Yeah.
The other one I know they were thinking of was Tommy Lee Jones. Might have worked. That might have worked.
Yeah. I think, you know, at least, like, there's something about, like, Russell as Snake. Like, he is such, like, he's a cool guy while still being like a believable military dude. Like, it works on both levels. And again, like, Carpenter and him, I remember on the Dearly Departed AV Club, they had like a list of like best commentaries to listen to on DVDs, and they said like anything of the Russell and Carpenter one, because it's just like two guys hanging out who just love each other's company and are like probably stoned together, just like enjoying a movie. And that's, I think, like, that camaraderie you can see on screen. I just love it.
The energy just like is fed off them. And like, just to go back to like the casting, like, Kurt Russell is so like cool in this movie. Like, there's no sense of the of any tension really below other than when he's like backed into a corner. But like, Tommy Lee Jones would have just been such a teapot all the time. Like, you could just like, you could just feel him sizzling all the time. That's what his whole thing was at the time. It'd be a totally different movie, but I actually I think about that a lot, and I kind of would have liked to see that movie.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, I was reading some interviews with Kurt Russell for this movie, and he explained his character of Snake, where he's only thinking about the next 60 seconds. Like, how do I survive the next 60 seconds? And what I like about him upon watching this movie again, just his attitude, he's never celebrating any victories. He doesn't, like, winning is just surviving. And, like, when he survives the end of the movie, he's not like, yes, finally, I'm out of New York, hooray! He's just like, I am pissed off at everyone who made me do this, and I'm going to ruin your little peace summit. Yep. I hate all of you. So this movie, Carpenter didn't want to film it on a back lot. They didn't have the budget to actually film in New York City. And, you know, there's a lot of people in New York City. So it's like, very expensive to clear off streets and make it look abandoned. So they chose the city that looked the most abandoned, which at the time, it's been very gentrified now from what I've heard. But East St. Louis, Missouri was just a blighted hellscape of like urban, desolation. Wow. And apparently a fire had ripped through a huge portion of town just a few years earlier. So they had like free reign to just play in this abandoned city, and they got the city to shut off lights in certain areas so they could set up their own lights. So they lucked out by, deindustrialization just ruining a city, basically.
Wow. Well, that's how they used Detroit, like parts of like destroyed Detroit for what was it? One of the Transformers movies for sure. They just destroyed huge buildings for it. But also Alex Cross, the shitty Tyler Perry, James Patterson adaptation, uses it. Like, if there ever was a sign of cultural degeneration, absolutely destroyed St. Louis to make Escape from New York, and we used Detroit to make Transformers and the fucking latest Alex Cross mystery.
Yeah,
like, absolute horror.
There are certain cities, there are certain projects you would sacrifice a city for, and I would not count any of the Alex Cross projects as one of them. Even my own hometown that I hate. Don't kill it for Alex Cross.
Just for Tyler Perry's attempt at a franchise crossover thing to get, yeah.
And I think, like, some stuff on location, there's some stuff in L.A. they filmed, some soundstage stuff there, mostly the stuff with Hauk. And the opening they threw away, that was filmed in Atlanta. We'll talk more about that later. But, yeah, mostly taking place, like, all being shot at night, just the worst time to shoot an entire movie on the streets of East St. Louis. And legendary people worked on this movie, people that would become legendary, like Dean Cundey, legendary cinematographer. Of course, he'd go on to work with Zemeckis and Spielberg. He's a cinematographer on all the Back to the Future movies and Roger Rabbit. And Spielberg's early 90s stuff as well, Jurassic Park.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think
yes,
that's right. Yeah,
Jurassic Park as well. And very recently, he just, I think the second episode of The Book of Boba Fett, he shot.
Right.
And I haven't seen, I never thought to just look at what Dean Cundey looks like. He looks like Santa Claus. It's incredible. Like, he's such a beloved man, would just look like the most like gregarious. Like, he, it's amazing. He looks like Brendan Gleeson should play Dean Cundey in something.
Maybe like Kurt Russell, he aged into being Santa Claus.
Impossible.
Man, the difference between that episode 2 and 3 of Boba Fett makes a lot more sense now.
And hey, We Hate Movies is a whole miniseries on the Book of Boba Fett on your Patreon.
We do indeed. I'm not enjoying it, but it was nice to see Dean on there.
Yeah.
It was very nice to see him working on something.
I stand by quoting Lur from Futurama of just like, why does Boba Fett not simply kill his enemy? Like, I don't understand this.
Oh, that's
like,
too easy.
Yeah.
But yeah, other people on
much
the
much nicer to give them all lollipops.
Other people on the movie, of course, James Cameron. He's doing visual effects. I think he's doing a lot of the fake CG in the movie and some matte paintings as well.
And some of the smartest stuff in that movie. Until I saw like in the aughts some behind the scenes on it, I was sure it was like, oh, this is like some of the earliest CG movies. It's like this in Tron. I was like, no, I'm stupid. I got tricked by like the oldest style of special effects. I love that.
Yeah, those shots that you see on the monitors of, you know, the first-person view of going through New York, like the CGI wireframe, it's in fact models that they're making the corners glow, and just moving a camera through those with, like, a black light. It's so effective, and they could have paid for early CGI. They could have paid a lot of money, but it still works. It's just this mercenary filmmaking.
It's just, it's thinking on a budget. It's just so beautiful. Like, I think about this all the time. It's just, like, you didn't, like... I understand part of it is to show off the money now. Like, it's not so much even the quality of the thing. It's just to show off that we can do something like this. But, like, you think back at this stuff, and it's like, you could spend $10 and get to an effect that's just as powerful as an image, like, just as an image that's impactful.
Mm-hmm. It really works. And we were just talking about, what were we talking about before the recording? Oh, Star Trek Generations, which, again, you've done an episode about on your podcast, Chris. And I remember watching that. I watched it recently so I could listen to the podcast. And it was like the last Star Trek thing I can remember that had models in it. Mm-hmm. Like when a ship explodes, it's a model. So as cheesy as they look, I love seeing the matte paintings in this movie. And I love seeing the models. Even though the artifice is on display, I love the artifice. And I kind of miss it. This is an old man perspective. You've heard it before, but I must restate it.
I feel that's definitely the way you have to be, because, like, I think of when you go into these movies, it's a deal. Like, you're making a deal with the movie. You're like, I'm going to believe in some of the more spectacular or, like, inconsistent ideas in your world here. And, you know, you're going to entertain me. That's going to be the trade-off here, is I'm going to believe in some of your shit, and you're going to entertain me, is the idea. And now, like... So, like, seeing a little model, like, I don't be like, oh, that's so cheap. Who fuck? I'm not convinced at all. I'm like, no, okay. You're telling me what you want me to believe. I get it.
Yeah, you dropped a little plane, like, off a model, and it looks kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to literalize it all in, like, fucking digital fucking information. It doesn't do anything.
No, it's, I these days, the cheapness, when I see the cheap fix for something... Usually the answer is just like, well, yeah, green screen. These three actors weren't there the same day, and so the green screen was used.
Samuel L. Jackson's desk is fake.
Yeah, that head is not Tom Holland's head. It's somebody else's head. Like, it's just, yeah.
It's lies. It's what it is. In this movie, more behind-the-scenes stuff about it, you can watch this on YouTube, actually. So there was a cut opening. We see the bank robbery that presumably landed Snake in the super jail that we see him brought to at the beginning of the movie. It's fun to watch. It's well shot. I mean, a lot of it's just still on video because it was never, you know, finished. But Carpenter said it's not necessary, so let's just get rid of it. And as it stands, the movie... it's a long time before you get to the Snake train. Like, Snake does not give his first line of dialogue until I counted 18 minutes in.
Ow.
I think he says, call me Snake, and that's the first thing he says 18 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, ballsy. Pretty ballsy.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we see him...
Let the eye patch do all the work.
Yeah. I mean, we see him kind of obscured, being, like, marched through the prison, being taken off the bus, but it's not until, you know, enough plot elements happen that we realize, like, oh, we need Snake, so here he is.
Yeah, I mean, the failed robbery is, like, it's fun, but not, like, so amazing that you're like, oh, well, you got to keep this in there. And it's nice background. And as far as, like, a DVD extra, like, it's fun to watch now. It's like, oh, that's how this could have started. But especially for a film that is just, like, so tight, like, it that extra, like, 8 minutes that the movie could have started with would have hurt that that the excellent pacing the film has.
I think so.
And the urgency of the movie really does hinge on the unknowability of almost anything. Like, you don't know Snake. You don't know what New York has really become. What, you know, it's a prison, but you don't really know what's been going on in there, really. That the mystery of it is what makes it so alluring. Like, just that scene of, like, the lady being pulled down through the floor for no reason, and you never explain exactly why that happened, and you just somebody took her. Like, stuff like that, to explain it too much, and, like, it dulls it. Like, I've watched the extra scene, and it just dulls the whole experience for me.
Yeah, it hurts that you see the outside world. I love the economy of the movie, and I love the storytelling choices. They're both for the sake of budget, but for the sake of mystery. There are so many just drop lines in this movie where you're thinking, okay, what battle did Snake fight in? when they're trying to convince him to do the mission, they say, "We're at war, Snake. We hear about this peace summit between Russia and China. We don't know what'll happen if it doesn't go through." Like, seemingly Snake dooms the United States at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
We hear drop lines about, these different gangs, the crazies and the this's and the that's. We hear about, the brain gets gas for the Duke, and he's got, like, an oil derrick in the library. Like, all these little details that imply big things that are not discussed because they're just part of the world.
Yeah, if I may make another old man complaint here, but this is being mad at me and my generation. These type of lines in movies that were meant for world building, that have just like, yes, they show you that this exists in a world and with a history to itself, and these are just the hints at that. And then me, our generations, like, grew up saying, but what about all of it? Explain it all to me, please. And so now that's why everything, all the side stuff has to exist. It's like, see, we answered all the questions. They really did this with Star Wars, but it's like, I now going back to it, like, unanswered questions are fine now. You know what?
Yeah.
I don't need an answer to everything.
It's like, I'm sure that Snowpiercer show is good, but I like the movie and just the world it hinted at. I don't know if I need three seasons explaining, like, here's what's happening in this car.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I liked the experience of seeing it the way I saw it. Like, I mean, you're absolutely right about, I don't know, like, I don't blame the fans asking those questions as much as I blame them for thinking it was something that needed to be fixed. Mm-hmm. Like, I still think about it. That's one of my biggest problems with that latest Spider-Man, is that that's all it did. That's so much of that movie is just being like, oh my God, all these things that you complained about the original two versions of the Spider-Man are now being answered or corrected in some way in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's somewhat what was happening with all culture at this point, is like, we have to correct everything so people like it. Even the people on Reddit who don't like anything.
Yeah. It displays a real lack of confidence. And this is a very confident movie, I think. It just trusts the audience. And even though the story is very simple, the world it implies is much bigger than just what's happening inside of this this city prison.
And the balls on them to just say, like, this is 1997. We know this will date it. We know that someday it'll be after 1997, and you'll know it won't look like this, but we don't care. This is 1997.
I feel like if they just fixed the subtitle to be, like, 2017, I'd buy it more. It was like, 97, it was great. It was a party. 2017, I can see this happening.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Well, it was fine. The worst thing was the president getting a blowjob. It was happy days are here again, honestly, yeah, as compared to now.
And then so funny.
Did you know that originally they wanted it at, like, they said it was going to be, I think Carpenter wanted it like 6 years in the future originally, like 1987.
It's even funnier.
Like that.
I think there was a compromise because the movie starts by saying, okay, 1988, crime rises very high. And then 97, I think 88's when they cordon off Manhattan, and then 97, just like, well, here we are now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was a bit of a compromise there. But yeah, I mean, God, Reagan just got elected. So I don't know if Carpenter is not really reflecting on Reagan like he was in They Live. He's really reflecting on, like, Nixon and everything with this movie, but still very, very prescient, because his future movies would really reflect upon what Reagan did to the country, especially They Live. I mean, it's like the thesis statement of that movie.
Yep.
Take a time machine back to before the world went to hell, around the year 2000.
The 80s and 90s were so rad. The movies, the music, the TV, the games, that's what I want to talk about.
If you're cool enough,
join us and listen to Less Than 2000, because that's all we talk about.
Adam and Chad Live.
Less Than 2000.
Now part of the
HyperX
Podcast Network.
Previously on Chat of the Wild.
Good to know.
I wanted to use this time to impart some words of wisdom from Eslo. Straighten up your hair once I'm gone. You got a style all over the ladies. La 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 are the words to his new hit single, Live Long, Love Long. And also, he woke up from a dream where he forgot to study for the test. So
did he really say all those things?
Yeah, yeah. These are all things that I discussed, that he discussed with me.
That's magical.
Chat of the Wild, breaking down Zelda and Zelda-like games, one dungeon at a time. Wednesdays on the HyperX Podcast Network.
Live long, love long, baby.
Words of wisdom.
I want to go over casting really quick. So, Henry, I know you have info on who played Slag. Henry is a big wrestling fan. You probably know that if you've heard our podcast before. But Slag, when I saw the guy, I thought, you know, if you look like this in 81, you have to be a professional wrestler or some sort of just a military strongman. So who is he?
That's Ox Baker is his name. He was a wrestler who got his start in the 60s. He was big in the Midwest territories with the AWA. He didn't have a big run in the WWF back in the 80s. So that's why my generation of wrestling fans know him a lot less. I know him more for this movie. And he's also in the Jackie Chan movie, the Big Brawl or something. One of the ones that the Big Brawl. He's in that. But he's such, like, his giant eyebrows and goatee are so memorable. He's more known for that than wrestling now. He lived until 2014 to 80 years old, which that is very old for a wrestler. Wow. But the interesting story about it was that he was not Carpenter's first choice for wrestler. There's an even crazier looking wrestler whose name was Bruiser Brody, who is actually a really great wrestler. Ox Baker, not good at wrestling, but a good looking face. And so I think the movie would have been even better because I think Bruiser Brody could have done better, like, acting of action, but he turned it down. He's like, what? I'm not Paul Newman. I don't act and stuff. I'm just going to go to Japan and wrestle. None of this for me. So Ox Baker got it because Bruiser Brody was like, nah, no thanks.
He should have looked at the script. Slag has no lines.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if he had any lines. I wonder if they ended up on the cutting room floor. But yeah, it's like the look he has in the wrestling ring in the movie is exactly how he looked. It, like that hairy bod with giant goatee and huge eyebrows. That's him. But,
that's the story of Slag.
Do you think that, like, because Ox Baker, if you have a name like that, do you just have to become a strongman? Like, you can't just become a computer programmer, right? If you do that, right? You got it would be amazing if I had an accountant named Ox, but I don't think that would ever happen. Like, I feel like you have to. You're pulled to that.
He has the perfect, like, barrel body. Like, he is barrel chested, just hairy. Like, he looks like he should be fighting Popeye. Like, he's
The Bluto bod is not in fashion anymore. He definitely had one.
Yep. And his finisher, now everybody has amazing, like, wrestling moves. He was so simple that his finisher was just called the heart punch, which is just punch somebody in the chest, which literally anybody can do in the ring. And his storyline was that he would go to town and they'd be like, you know, his heart punch killed a man in the last town. It's like, but I don't believe he actually ever killed anyone.
And that's where they got the idea for Kano.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think if you see Ox Baker in this movie, in Double Dragon, Karnov, like, I feel like that guy, he inspired the look of a few game enemies in the 80s, for sure.
But I do want to run down the cast list very quickly here. So we talked about Kurt Russell. We talked enough about him. When I watch this movie, I forget how old Kurt Russell is. I'm like, what is he, 40 in this movie? No, he's a little baby. He's 30 years old, but he has just the character of just a grizzled man, like maybe 45. I'm surprised just how much he can carry this off. And a fun fact about him, the apocryphal fact is like, oh, Kurt Russell are the last words Disney ever spoke. It's actually one of the last things Walt Disney wrote down was the words Kurt Russell on a piece of paper. So yeah. I don't know if he was just, going through whatever, the DMT was being released and he just was frantically writing things down. But that's a true fact.
Yeah, you can you can find a young Kurt Russell on like A Wonderful World of Disney meeting Walt Disney. Like the two of them share the screen together in some old footage.
And then
I haven't been to the Disney and I haven't been to Disney World in so long, but I had no idea that footage existed. That's insane.
He was the future of the company, and then he went to make a filthy movie like this. And then we have Lee Van Cleef as Hauk. So, I mean, he's a spaghetti western star, huge in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, a movie I just saw for the first time in 2021. Please make fun of me. I know I should have seen it a long time. It's a very long movie. It's intimidating, but it's worth watching.
Very long. It's very big.
And I really knew him through Mystery Science Theater because after doing this, he would do a TV series for NBC called The Master, in which he played a white ninja. And those episodes were repackaged into two movies, Master Ninja 1 and 2, featured on Mystery Science Theater. So I knew him as like the white ninja who would not do any of his own stunts.
He's the greatest. Like, he's also in for a few dollars more, the one right before it. He is so awesome in it. He is like this older marksman type dude and like the rival, not the enemy for Clint Eastwood, but his rival in the movie. And yeah, I mean, once you see him, especially in his Silver Fox era of this movie, this is Revolver Ocelot. Like, is Revolver Ocelot of Metal Gear Solid.
I wasn't thinking about that. No, you're right about that. And I have to wonder also if the earring was his idea. Was he like, I'm going to be a cool guy in his 50s. It's 1981. Or is it like John Carpenter thinking, you've never seen this guy wear an earring. It's the future.
It's the future.
Yeah. Even Lee Kling, even Lee Van Cleef will wear an earring and not be afraid of being called fruity or whatever. So that's Lee Van Cleef.
Yeah, I would like any of those to be true. I mean, he's been around since John Ford. Like, he did one of his first movies with The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Yes.
And, like, he's just had this face for forever. That's just, like, burned into my brain. And, like, I did not know that about the repackaging, but I've watched those episodes of Mystery Science Theater thousands of times.
An early Demi Moore role in those as well.
Oh, right.
So, that's Lee Van Cleef. So, next guy is a very small role, probably doesn't even need to be in the movie, but Tom Atkins is Rame or Remy. I forget. They say his name once, but it's spelled R-E-H-M-E. He was just in The Fog, given a small role in this movie. He sort of just is there to butt heads with Hauk. But, I mean, they're both, like, bad people and villains in a way. So you're not really rooting for either one of them. And they really lose contact with Snake pretty early on in the movie. So it's not necessary to cut back to them, but it does show you what's happening outside, which I guess is kind of useful.
You get a little taste of the Colonel on the codec between them, but not a ton. Yeah. I always forget every time I watch the movie, I'm like, they're talking to each other a lot. And then the walkie-talkie breaks so soon, I was like, I guess that's the end of him talking to Lee Van Cleef.
I assumed it would be like Metal Gear Solid, constantly like crouching behind things saying, Colonel, what's going on? Yeah. The president's missing. So that's Tom Atkins. Ernest Borgnine, I was shocked to see him in this movie. I think 90s kids know him best either from being on the Simpsons episode Boy Scouts in the Hood or playing Mermaid Man on SpongeBob.
When he died, I looked up stuff of like, the memorial or like best scenes of him or whatever. Every video was just all about Mermaid Man. Like, he was Mermaid Man to a generation of kids who are slightly younger than us that grew up on SpongeBob. I mean, I knew him from Simpsons too, or just him being in like, goofy things of just like, look at that. It's Ernest Borgnine. How do you like it? I mean, and again, he's in another of the best westerns ever, The Wild Bunch. Like, he rules.
It's just fun to see Ernest Borgnine in a post-apocalyptic movie. Yeah. And I feel like I would try to be a cabbie figure in this world. Like, he is embracing it. He's having a good time. Everyone else is just miserable. He's like, I want to go see this show at this bad part of town. And of course, I brought my Molotov cocktails and I've got this great music collection. And I run a functioning business in the city prison.
I still have a running taxi that hasn't been taken in this decade here. And he comes off as such like a dippy guy. He's like, gee, Snake, you're such a cool guy. I love you. But when he is so casually just tossing Molotov cocktails, it's like, you're a stone. You didn't accidentally get a taxi this good. You've killed a lot.
No.
Yeah.
No, you need the he's the oil that cuts the vinegar. You need a little bit of that. I think Nick Castle really brought a lot of the humor. From what I've heard of the original Carpenter draft, it was way more grim, way more violent than this one. This ended up being. I think Borgnine was a big character that Castle worked on.
There's just enough.
And he's fantastic,
definitely. And there's just enough Cabby in the movie where he's not annoying or really like cutting the attention or drama.
Cabby knows when to leave and come back in. He's like, you know what? This is too serious. I'm out of here. Like he leaves. Like, yeah. and I mean, just hearing his Bandstand song is so funny of an entrance music for him, but it pays off with the end of the movie. Like Cabby yeah. is the soul of the film. He's the last joke of it all.
He's the carrier of the MacGuffin, and we also have. Donald Pleasance as the president, John Harker, I think they say his name in the movie, but I love Pleasance. He is of the British school of, like, I will do anything for money. I'm an actor. Put me in anything. Of course, he's in Halloween. Carpenter loves working with him. He'll be in, like, every Halloween movie until he dies in, like, 1995. But I love his turn from, no-nonsense president to cowering, loser to stone-cold murderer to this, like, pompous, prissy guy at the end. This journey this character takes where you realize, like, oh, he sucks, too. I hate him as well.
Yeah, he's like the least presidential president in any movie. Like, even I think when they take him and he gets in the red egg, there's this weakness in him from the beginning that I feels very Carpenter, like noteworthy of his attitude towards politics in general and government in general. And it's so when he gets on the wall at the end, it pays off so well. Like,
yes,
you're number one.
And he's just this like little fat British guy who's like, how did you get elected? Yep. Like I got, but then again, the people who take over his plane are just like, they're reading off the riot act of all the stuff he's done. So I would assume there is some anti-democratic means by which he maintains his presidency in this future.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
I love that scene in the beginning of the hijacking where just like, what is happening in the world? They're calling it a fascist police state. You realize it sets up, oh, yeah, this president should not be rescued. In fact, the world might be better if he just goes down in the city and dies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, too, it's like kind of a prism politically you can look through on it, because I would bet in 81, if you're one of the people who unironically loves Death Wish, and it's about how, yeah, you finally got to pick up a gun and really get those sickos in New York City yourself. If you're one of those types you see at the start of the movie, it says crime increased by 400%. You would think, of course it does. It's gone to hell in a handbasket. But that opening with the people taking over the ship makes it clear, like, maybe it was that crime got reclassified mm-hmm. entirely by 88, and that anything is a crime and you get to, and everybody gets branded a criminal because of that. Like, that's why it statistically goes up. Not that there's more of what we consider crime, but that lots more things became crimes that get you sent to Manhattan.
And there's one little dark fact buried in the movie that I noticed this second time I watched it. It's people always saying to Snake, I thought you were dead, when they meet him. And it implies to me that the government reports that you have died, and then you're sent to that prison, which is why when you walk through it, they say, if you want us to assassinate you here and cremate you, we will.
Wow.
Before you even enter the prison. Yep. So it tells me, like, you've been reported dead. So you're just not a person anymore, period.
Oh, yeah. All that reaction is them just repeating back the propaganda they've been told by the media. Wow, that's yeah, you're so right. You are so right.
Absolutely.
So just to rush through the rest of these actors here, Harry Dean Stanton as Brain, he just passed away in 2017, I believe in his 90s, when he was acting up until the end, like in the last season of Twin Peaks, the reboot season he was in that. And, you know, mostly known for his work with Lynch at the end of his career, but he was in cult films of the 80s like Paris, Texas and Repo Man, and just like a legendary character actor.
Mm-hmm. The greatest.
One of the best.
And he was an old man for a very long time.
He's old in this.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah. It's true.
And so we have Adrienne Barbeau as Maggie. She worked on Someone's Watching Me with John Carpenter. That's a TV movie he made. She's in The Fog as well. She was known for being just a very busty lady, and that is why she's in this movie. And there are interviews with her that say, yes, I realize this is why I was hired a lot. And when I would come down the stairs on All in the Family, people would be hooting and hollering like it was the Fox Network or something. So, yes.
She, She's a good actress too. It's not just about her shapely figure, but yes, I mean, costuming wise, she has a very open chest in her costume in this. Yes,
and I guess story wise,
they're not giving her many turtlenecks.
No. In the story, if you want to justify it, it makes sense because she's like a gift. Mm-hmm. She's like a woman given to Brain in this movie.
And yeah. I like that she is quick to pull out a gun and kill somebody if she needs to, because it shows like how did any woman survive this long in this hellscape, especially someone as beautiful as her. I think part of that is like she can defend herself when she needs to, like she isn't like waiting around for the Brain to save her. Like, she's the brawn in their group anyway. Like,
definitely
he's just the dork who goes like, well, you can't kill me, I know this.
I know how to make gasoline.
Yeah,
there's an interesting bit of story building in this movie where
he's Otacon. He's the door. Yeah,
I can see that. Yeah, although anyway. Otacon is better than this guy.
Yes.
But in the movie, there's an interesting bit of storytelling and world building in that when Snake is looking for the president at first, he goes to that theater where the men are putting on a drag show. So you think, oh, there aren't women in this prison. That's why the men are putting on this drag show, because there are no women to play the parts. When he goes to the basement, there's a woman being assaulted, and you're like, oh, there are women in the prison, and it's not good for them at all.
That's a dark step. But then him, like, that also lets you have a cool scene of him, like, fighting back those dudes and just, like when he just, like, bam, bam. It also made me feel old of, like, oh, 40 years ago, this was, like, the action scene of just, like, he took out two guys, like, there we go. I'm established as a badass. Like, that's all you need for me in this movie.
The camera.
Eye patch and a couple punch.
Yeah, the camera didn't need to move at all.
Nope.
And last on the list is Isaac Hayes as the Duke. Obviously, a musical legend at the time. He'd done some acting before this, but this is just stunt casting for novelty value, but it works. He's not given a lot to say, but his presence is enough to let you know, like, he's an important and kind of menacing figure in this world, and he's also very, very cool.
Yeah, you could have really made this character over the top. Anybody else is in this role, they might overplay this role. And I think the fact that he is kind of just, I mean, the amount of screen time is pretty low, but like also the fact that you don't have him saying much and you are just allowing that, it does bring him down to the level of just a local kingpin, a local crime kingpin, rather than like some way overblown sadistic maniac. Like, he's just a crime boss, and that makes it feel way more convincing. And it helps me get into the world a lot more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and even though he is like king shit, but he's on Turd Mountain. So even though he's like a crime boss here, his life isn't great. Mm. He's trying to escape as well. His cool Cadillac is just like salvaged chandeliers and disco balls.
Yes.
He lives in like a slum with everyone else. Like, he has some power, but still, you can only rise so high in this prison. Your life can only be so good in the Manhattan City Jail.
Mm. Yeah, but him getting to torture the president is just so great. Like, it's just the excitement on his face when he gets that gun to shoot, just keep shooting at the president. He's like, man, this fucking rule. Like, he's just having a great time. Yeah.
But yeah, I want to.
That's number one on the bucket list. Come on. Yeah, I mean, I would be like, okay, yeah, do whatever you want to me after this, man. Snake, go take over. Yeah, go ahead, take him. I'm fine. Take me now.
We went over the casting of the movie. I want to go over a few just discussion points, because we've been talking about different scenes and elements of the movie throughout, but there's a few more things I want to hit. Just what I really like about the movie, what really gets you on Snake's side about this movie, is just how cynical every character is. There's very little virtue in these characters, but the people he's working for immediately are established as just terrible people. Like, the first scene is people trying to escape a prison. They're murdered. Like, you are just murdered in cold blood for escaping. Snake reluctantly agrees to help, and they immediately say, well, we're going to put things in your neck. Well, they put things in his neck and say, well, now you're going to die in 22 hours, so you better hurry up. So he's immediately betrayed.
Yeah, totally betrayed. But then but they also tell him, like, we know you were going to betray us and just fly to Canada, so fuck you. Like, which they're probably right. Snake probably was going to go like, oh, yes, I'm definitely going to fly into New York City, and then instantly, like straight into Montreal.
Yeah, and the president.
Yeah, the idea is that like everybody is like terrible, but like at least Snake is honest about it. Like Snake's not bullshitting you. That's like the whole trick of it. Whereas the artifice of order and like stateliness at the place is just so eerie. Like when you do that intro through the prison, like the order of it all is what like makes you most fearful.
Mm-hmm. And Snake is, I don't think he's like overpowered or superpowered because he does get beaten up a lot in the movie. But what I like about him, his superpower is immediately being able to see through everyone's bullshit. Mm-hmm. He does not put up with it for a second. He's just like, I figured you out instantly. I know exactly what you're about. I don't have time for small talk. Just like get to the points. You know, he can just, he's got the best bullshit detector in the entire movie, I think.
Absolutely.
I think the only actually nice person in the movie is that doctor who's just like, all right, you got to tell him. Like, you're not going to just lie about this.
That guy was fired or just murdered by Hauk, I think, after the lab scene.
There's that great look on Hauk's face when he says, like, well, if you don't tell him, I will. And he's like, what? Hey. Like, he's like, that wasn't part of the deal. Like, but then this guy actually, I guess, kind of respects the Hippocratic Oath. And on some level, he's like, look, I just killed a man. So you should at least admit to him that I just killed him by putting this in his stack. Which then, and the Suicide Squad comics ripped that off for their suicide missions they were sent on with a thing put in their skull that then got put into a movie 30 years after that. So then it's the movies are just a ripoff of a ripoff of this movie.
It's wild that you bring that up because the first thing I thought when they do the first incursion of soldiers to go try to get the president before Snake goes in, that reminded me so much of the shitty Suicide Squad David Ayer movie when they come in and try to, and the muck creatures, I don't even know what the fuck those things were.
Yeah.
Those things go after them. Like the shots are almost identical in certain scenes. It's really amazing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that scene too, because you have this presumably fascist government just throwing people in this jail saying they're dead, but even with all of their powers they still can't do anything.
They still
can't get one guy out of there, so it's like we have to get another criminal in there and throw this guy in the meat grinder because we just can't do anything.
We
can do is lock people up, which is, you know, there's some similarities between our modern government sometimes.
Also, what a great metaphor.
Prophetic.
What a great metaphor that the key guard spot for Manhattan is on Liberty Island. Like,
yeah.
That's so great. Just like, and it says like Liberty Island, what, detention center or something, this big sign at the start of the movie.
It's funny, like I'm sitting on our meet call, Google Meet call. I'm sitting in front of the poster, which has the downed Statue of Liberty. Did I miss that? Is that actually in the movie?
Nah.
You see it in one. It's one of the computer shots where you see the outline of it as like the point. Like,
okay.
That you never actually see it for sure. Because, I mean, there's not much New York iconography. It's kind of the cab and the digital Statue of Liberty, and that's it.
Got it. Yeah.
The Twin Towers, I can't stop looking at at any time.
Oh,
It's kind of, I guess, darkly funny that in this movie, a plane crashes into a non-World Trade Center building, but the plane lands safely on the World Trade Center. Yes. So you're like, well, this is very different. Yes.
And Cloverfield ripped off that the poster imagery of the big of the head of the Statue of Liberty in the street.
Big time.
Yeah.
And more of what the movie does that I like, I really like just how much time it gives everything to breathe. It's like an 88-minute movie or a 90-minute movie. It's like about an hour and a half. But there are just so many scenes of just like walking, following Snake. One of my favorite scenes in the movie is Snake. He finds the president's tracker that he had is on his arm, but it's actually on this unrelated bum. And he's like, he walks outside and he just sits down in a chair. And they kind of sit with him for about half a minute. He's just thinking, well, what the fuck do I do now? That is a great scene that I don't think would be even in a 90s action movie. Just a character sitting and thinking, I am so screwed.
Yeah, like,
I have 18 hours left to live. What is going to happen next?
Well, I mean, would you think that any other... I can't imagine any other movie allowing an entrance like Frank Doubleday's to happen. Like, it's so unassuming, so quiet, and so like overwhelming once you see him and see the way he talks and acts. Like it just takes time, and it really does affect how the movie comes off. Like, he is imposing. This little like it looks like an anime character. He looks like he's about to go Super Saiyan. Like it's all of a sudden you're just freaked out by this world in this moment, and it's because of him. And it's because you allowed him to come into the movie like this.
I love that he's able to pull rank on Lee Van Cleef, who's like such a heavy, and he's like, seriously, no, 18 seconds, 17. Like, no, and when you say anime character, like, absolutely, I absolutely think the visual of this guy influenced animators in Japan in the 80s for like, I can think of specific dudes in cartoons from that came out 5 years after this are like, oh, you just drew that guy. Like you drew that guy with his giant hair and his sunken cheeks and just this freakish character. And also the hobo he finds is like the guy who's always the hobo in the Carpenter movie.
He was the hobo in Back to the Future as well.
Right, yeah.
Crazy drunk drivers, yeah.
I love him in They Live. It's just like when he sells out, he's like, come on, man, everybody's selling out. Like he's just so, and yeah, just the disgust Snake has when he sees him, like, ugh.
Yeah, it's like, I don't have time to even beat you up. I hate you for not being who I want you to be. Yeah, like there are so many fun scenes in this movie that I think really show who Carpenter is as a person. You talked about that, Chris, like this movie is like his personality is in this movie. One scene I really like that anyone could watch and think, well, that's a throwaway scene. It's just when Snake, he's being pursued by the crazies or whatever. They're just kind of like almost zombie-like people. A horde is following him. He ducks into this cafe, and he meets this woman who knows who Snake is. And by the way, that's Kurt Russell's wife at the time, Susan Hubley, I think her name was.
Really?
But the movie makes you think like, oh, romantic interest for Snake. Okay. She is killed within like 90 seconds of meeting Snake. So there is no rest for Snake. There is no romance for Snake. Snake doesn't like eat or have sex in this movie. There's none of those needs are fulfilled for him. It's just pure mission for him. And I love that about his character and about like just Carpenter's direction for this movie. Like we're not going to have time for romance. Maggie's not falling in love with Snake in this movie.
No, yeah. No, I mean, I think Starman's like his only one that's actually about like love. I feel like all the that actually has like a successful romance in it, because like in They Live, they tease that he's like, this woman really likes Roddy Piper. It's like, no, she's a sellout. She shoots him in the back, literally. Like she's awful. Oh, and just no, the way they're all pulled through the way she's pulled through the ground and like she's just not seen again. That is spooky stuff.
Yeah.
Unsettling, and like that is it goes with what you were talking about like the women in this. Adrian Barbeau has made a decision that like that's also a survival decision, being with Brain. Like it's not just about like I can take care of myself. If this lady who does come off as a survivor when we meet her is just easily taken out like that, I mean it gives you the whole world view right there. You know, the thing I come back to with this movie is the way it's lit, the way like we had to rewatch The Eternals recently because we're doing an episode very soon. And a lot of those, and it's a common thing you hear now, is like all dark scenes are way too dark. You can't really see what's going on in them. And they go on for way longer than most dark scenes would in other, like even in the aughts would go on. Like that's true of Star Wars movies. That's true, and it's a thing for streaming. I've come to understand.
Oh yeah.
And like movie like this, where I just can so clearly see the use of light and shadow, and like this old school understanding of like. And I understand I'm arguing for like form in a time when we don't care about form anymore. But like it is, to me, it is so distinct, and it hits me so much harder than this like blending of darkness and lightness that is supposed to be like representative of us all coming together, but actually just makes you fucking impossible to see anything.
Yeah, you're totally right. Like the way images can communicate information, even all these dark scenes in this movie, it takes me back to almost like film noir, where when we see Snake walk into Hauk's office, the top half of him is just shrouded in darkness in a very unrealistic way, but you still can get a really cool reveal with him. And at no point when watching this movie you're like, what's happening, where is everybody? Just like they know where to put light and they know where to guide your eye towards in order to convey this information. It's so masterfully done, and obviously Dean Cundey is like a genius when it comes to this stuff.
The best of them all.
One of the most striking shots in the movie to me is, and that I think also did influence a lot of like video games, especially in the days where you just had to like a person, a picture of their face is who's talking. Like him in the plane with the green and red on both sides of him as he's talking. Like, it's such a striking visual. Like, I just love that shot every time I see it. Yeah.
We have to get to the end of the movie because I do want to move on to the gaming adaptations and how it influenced gaming. Just a brief discussion about that. But I love the movie. I've heard people say I heard people say, like, oh, it's kind of anticlimactic. But I do like how it shows just how harsh this world is, where the Duke has this plan, like, we're going to drive across this bridge with the president strapped to the hood, you know, or as like a token, and Snake is going to be strapped to the hood. But even with the Duke's power, the brain, his associate, still has not figured out the minds on this bridge, because everybody dies within the span of like 5 minutes in this movie. And at a certain point, it gets unrealistic, but then you think, no, this is just how harsh this world is. Like, only Snake and one other man can make it out.
It's so brutal. Sometimes I wonder if it was done for economical reasons of like, well, these actors can't be here the same day as Lee Van Cleef is, so let's just kill them all off or something. I don't know. But I mean, as far as like brutality and let you know what a dark, like, broken world this is, everybody dies. Every named character you've known up to this point, other than Snake and the President, die on that bridge. And it's like just so, so rough. And it pays off because, like, that is why Snake is so disgusted looking at him. He's like, you don't even care that, like, 2 minutes ago, all these people died for your ass. Like,
and Donald Pleasance is just, like, preening in a little tiny mirror and, like, getting shaved and you know, pampered and everything. He's just like, oh, yes, the sacrifice is appreciated, or whatever he says.
They will go down in history, yes. You know, I really got to go.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. Time is very limited, you know. It it also calls back to like a tradition of like the Wild Bunch or even like Seven Samurai. Like, a lot of the main characters that weren't the main two characters die right before the end, because it's like about final sacrifice, all that stuff. I mean, to me, that's what's interesting about this movie, is it's not really about sacrifice. It's literally just escaping this hellhole, with some promise that you might be okay on the other end, but probably not. And yet the bluntness of this actual end, like when he plays the tape and the tape is the fucking music, like, it is just a blunt, like, fuck you. Like, this is how we communicate now in the world, is fuck you. Mm-hmm. Like that, and then you leave. That's like literally how it's been boiled down to.
It really shows how true the movie is to Snake's character, because the president says, you know, I'll give you anything, Snake. And he goes, a moment of your time. And he just wants to know, like, who really are you? Like, are you exactly what I think you are? Oh, you are. Goodbye.
Then I don't feel bad at all that I switched out the tapes like an hour or 5 minutes ago. So, yeah, just the little moment of like Cabby got the, like, how they handle it, that the double day guy is just wearing the cabbie hat, and he's like, yeah, I traded a tape. Like, it's seeming that guy doesn't even know that tape matters or was important. He's just like, yeah, I traded it for cabbie's hat. And so it's just sitting in cabbie's car, just right next to all his other tapes. Like, so, so great. It's not all in your face for the sleight of hand, but when it pays off, you're not feeling like you got cheated or like, when do you have time to do the cinema scene?
Exactly. And Snake plays about 8 seconds of the tape in Cabby's car just to make sure it's the real thing. And you hear just this brief snippet about chemical weapons, and you're thinking again, like, what is happening on the outside world? And then the implications for how much Snake fucked over the country at the end are pretty great. Like, are we about to be nuked by Russia and China in tandem because Snake just wanted to have revenge that he obviously deserves to give on these people?
I mean, whatever happened, at least trade has absolutely broken down for good. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but he's definitely fucked us for good. And a good on him is what I say.
Yeah, we had it coming.
And escape from L.A. tops that in an ending of pure cynicism, like even better. Yeah, it's what that's like my favorite, other than the basketball death match in Escape from LA. That's my favorite bit of that movie is the end of that.
I will eventually have to watch it, probably with I'll pregame before I watch that movie. I think I'll need to.
Yeah.
And speaking of gaming,
a little drunk.
Speaking of gaming, I do want to talk about the influence this had on games and game adaptations. So this movie came out in 81. At the time, it was still kind of rare for properties like this to get video game adaptations. There was a board game, a fan-made game came out for Commodore 64 in 85 with some like weird mini-games in it. It's not official, but you land Snake's plane on the World Trade Center. You run from left to right while jumping over the hands of the crazies trying to pull you in, and you're running down the bridge in another scene. It's just a little bunch of low-tech, fun video game adaptations of these scenes in the movie. But there was a canceled video game in the works. So in the mid-aughts, Namco was working on something called Snake Plissken's First Escape, and then it was known as Snake Plissken's Escape. And there is a video of this online, just like a trailer they made, and it looks like a mix of Devil May Cry, Metal Gear Solid, and Max Payne. A lot of games that were popular in the early to mid-aughts. And it was being made by the Dead to Rights team, that was a very short-lived series. That was kind of like, you know, brutal crime adventure kind of game. But these types of things were in the air at the time. Like, there was a video game sequel to The Thing in 2002 and a few other things. Like, there were some Evil Dead games. So they were doing this in the early to mid-aughts.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, Ash will live forever in video games. Like, there's an Evil Dead game coming out this year.
Oh, boy.
Like, yeah, but hey.
Oh, really?
Oh yep. Boy. Yeah. It looks like it's all right. But
I'll give it a shot.
I believe it's made by the Friday the 13th game makers, and that was a good game. But I played those Dead to Rights games. They are so funny because they are like a Japanese developer at the time, in a very of the style at the time, trying to make a Western style action game. Like, what do you guys like? You like cops who give headshots in slow motion, right?
Going
we can
to
make that.
Take a level set in strip clubs? Sure, we'll do it.
Yeah. And so, I mean, if Namco was going to get any team on Escape from New York, that's a team that makes sense. But yeah, also their games are much bigger action. They aren't sneaking games like how a Metal Gear is. So
it sounds like his first escape was a lot louder and involved a lot more gun violence. Because that didn't come out. People speculated, you know, Deborah Hill passed away in development. She was involved. It was speculated, and I think reported, that Carpenter would be writing music for the game. Kurt Russell would be doing the voice of Snake, but that never happened. But in looking into this project, I realized, like, there was this giant universe plan for the Escape franchise. Like, there was, he always wanted to make more. There's Escape from LA, of course, and then Ghosts of Mars is going to be Escape from Mars. And then he wanted to make Escape from Earth as well. There was so much planned for this. There was a potential anime series that never got off the ground in 2003. And then a TV series was greenlit in the year 2000, but then it was put on the back burner because of 9/11.
Ah, darn it.
Yeah.
And 9/11 ruined everything, man.
It always does. It's got a history of doing that.
That's
like, unrealized fucking Carpenter projects are just like the saddest thing to me. Mm-hmm. He had a haunted house movie that was taking place in a nuclear plant that sounded incredible. And it just some producer bought up the rights and just never gave it back. And that's it. But that's incredible. I had no idea. So there were like, because there were like two thing video games they tried to put out. One I know I remember playing, but like, do you know if they ever had like even D&D type games for or open world like type games for like Escape from New York? Or because it seems like it's that it would lend itself to the kinds of worlds.
There is a board game and it actually looks pretty cool. You can read about it on Board Game Geek. It explains how it's played. It has like pictures of the board and all the cards and stuff. It seems pretty neat, but that's the only like official licensed game that came out based on this property.
But it, man, I'm sad to know that we almost had an Animatrix starring Snake Plissken. Like, that again, that would work so well. Like, he just have him in little 6-minute adventures and animated by the best anime production companies of the early aughts, just like Animatrix, you know? Yeah.
And I shouldn't need to tell anyone listening to this, but the elephant in the room, we've been talking about it a few times during the podcast, but Metal Gear, hugely influenced by game creator Hideo Kojima. He was born in 63, so when he was in his early 20s to early 30s, he was living all of these 80s action movies and just being hugely influenced by them. Movies like Blade Runner, Aliens, what else? Terminator, just so many. Lethal Weapon, even. Like, he incorporated all of these ideas into his
RoboCop,
games. RoboCop
and,
2.
Yeah, and also The Great Escape. Like, he loves that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And Running Man.
Hideo Kojima has, you know, he has film guy brain. Like, he is like the arch film guy of Japan. Like, his Twitter account is mostly him just going like, hey, I just got the Blu-ray of El Topo. What a cool, which also if you see El Topo, that's like, oh, that's a boss rush run of like Metal Gear bosses. Like that movie is.
It really is. His Twitter account is really the best of times and the worst of times because yeah, he's like, oh yeah, I just got the Steelbook of El Topo or I got the new Fellini collection. And then he'll also say like, I love the Eternals. What a fantastic movie. He likes every movie equally, I think.
He loves movies. He just loves it. He's Greg Turkington.
Yes.
My wife played Death Stranding.
Mm.
And the one thing I will say about is like what you say about him having like a movie mind, he has that similar like throw the baby in the ocean type thing of like, just go into this world. I'll give you explanations along the way, but most of this is you just experiencing this world I built. And like you will find out something towards the end of it,
mm-hmm.
but literally you're just spending the whole time. And that's a Carpenter thing, like literally just like giving you bits of information that you build this skeleton ghost world around this person. I tried playing that game and I gotta say it tested my patience.
It does kick your ass. Yeah.
I know people who really like it, it certainly looks great.
Yeah,
it makes sense with him.
His games are all about like huge twists, misleading the player. Metal Gear Solid is basically Escape from New York with boss fights from The Running Man. So there aren't enough boss fights in Escape from New York. There's just one. So he takes the idea of these like big, interesting set pieces and then these interesting boss fights. And then mystery and intrigue, of course. You know, Snake in the video game, it's all about sneaking and infiltration. He's smoking a lot of cigarettes, of course.
And Big Boss has an eye patch also.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But on a legally distinct eye. It's on the other eye, not on the Kurt Russell eye. So the one thing he didn't do in the first game is like, oh, Solid Snake doesn't have an eye patch. But when you play as Solid Snake's predecessor, he does have an eye patch. And mm-hmm. there are more games starring him now.
And let's not also forget that in Metal Gear Solid 2, what's his code name when he returns?
Oh, Iroquois Plissken.
Yes.
Yeah,
you're good.
And what really hammers at home is like, I don't know what the Japanese dub of Escape from New York is like. I couldn't find any clips, but in the English dub of Metal Gear Solid, the voice of Solid Snake for most of the games is David Hayter, and he is doing the Kurt Russell, you know, the Clint Eastwood takeoff that Kurt Russell is doing. So like the dub actor knows what the game is really stealing liberally from.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's different in Japanese, but David Hayter knows he's doing the Kurt Russell impression of Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. Well, it's what Kojima wants. Like and it's a tribute. It's not just him being, you know, a ripoff artist. I think there's a lot of video games that just full on just steal a movie and make it a game, and that's cheap. But I do give the pass to Metal Gear Solid because it does turn it into a more of a story, especially for 1998.
Yeah.
Because the character Snake, even when you see him on the original video game from the 80s, like, yeah, you can see it there. But when you start up Metal Gear Solid and you hear a story about how people of great importance have been kidnapped on an island by a group of people, and this one guy named Snake has to be sent to it, and it's a colonel explaining it to him, and they even, like, when they show the island in Alaska, I think they even do the grid around the island visual that is in this movie, and he goes there with a pack of cigarettes. Also, in the middle of the game, just like in the middle of the movie, he is taken captive and stripped to the waist.
That's another video game trope, unfortunately, that stuck around, is that when you're captured and all your things are taken away, that happens in every video game.
It does. Every by extension, every video game took, like, inspiration from this, too. It wasn't just... Others took it, and they didn't... other people also just ripped off Metal Gear, which was ripping off Escape from New York. But there were other games that were just like, oh, well, I want to do an Escape from New York too. Because also, like, Snake is such a Snake Plissken is such a prototypical video game main character. Like, he has a history to him. He's can appear in a million things. He has tons of accessories. He's good at every weapon, which means you can play him in a video game really easily in a fun way. Yeah.
When they first tell Snake about the mission in Escape from New York, there's like a big table with all of his gear. They're just scanning across. Definitely very video gamey. And in Metal Gear Solid, so in Escape from New York, from the very beginning, Snake knows this is a suicide mission. I either do this or I die. In Metal Gear Solid, spoilers, of course, for this 24-year-old game now, you don't know, but you've been given a virus that you're spreading to all the different bosses you meet in the game, and that virus will eventually kill you. So throughout the entire series, the kind of point is the people you work for are awful and they're misleading you, and you're just a tool to be used in these endless conflicts. And that's sort of what's going on in Carpenter's view. I think the view is just as cynical in the Metal Gear series as it is in the Escape from New York movie.
Can I ask you, have you either of you seen Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead?
I've watched a lengthy review of it in clips, but not, I haven't seen it.
All I know is about the dead pixel in that movie.
Oh yes, that was pretty funny.
It's interesting. The influences of Carpenter on video games, I think, folds in on itself when it comes to something like Army of the Dead, which to me both feels like it's heavily influenced by Carpenter, but also is clearly trying to do a Borderlands Metal Gear Solid mashup type thing in this, like, absolutely destroy Las Vegas. And it's been interesting the last, like, 10, 15 years have been so, movies have been so influenced by video games that, like, if the video games themselves were influenced by movies, it all kind of collapses in on itself.
Absolutely.
So, like, I found myself watching Army of the Dead and being like, am I remembering a Carpenter shot? Or is that just from a game that had taken it from a Carpenter movie? Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, that movie really fucked me up because Snyder is clearly also a big gamer and a insane Carpenter man. And stuff like that, I see it more and more now. And the structure of this movie itself, before like video games even took on this kind of structure, or maybe they didn't, I just don't know about it. But like no, you have to go here. Oh no, it's not here, the thing you're looking for. You have to go here. Mm-hmm. Oh, this place is going to collapse and there's too many bad guys here. You have to go here.
Yeah, Rise of...
that is how it's strategized.
Rise of Skywalker felt like that to me too. Like, it was... The structure of it was like a bad video game.
Yeah.
Like, we need to get the radar to get the other radar to find the thing. And then, it was like a bunch of levels.
And, well, I mean, also, how many video games have you played in your life that end with... Hey, you know, countdown clock, you got to get out of here or else you're going to die. Race through it. Everything exploding around you. Race to it. Like, that's the... And no, I'm totally with you, Chris, with the folding in on itself thing of just like... Or the snake eating its own tail, because like Carpenter was referencing the stuff he grew up with. Then video games are made that reference this. And then... filmmakers like Zack Snyder grew up with like playing the video games and watching some of the movies too, and so he's like, oh, I'll just put all that together into this. And I was thinking about that watching the trailer for the Uncharted movie because Uncharted was the Uncharted games, which I had a lot of fun playing the Uncharted games, but their movie loafs, they're like, they're a tube, but you've called them story tubes a long time. And so, and they were just like, hey, the games were, let's do Indiana Jones. Let's just rip that off and have it star just like a completely forgettable guy. And then now they're making a movie that's like a ripoff of a ripoff of a ripoff. Like, it's just like so much. It's just cascading in on itself. It just feels very empty at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm really glad Chris brought that up because I was getting furious in a movie theater where, like, you're right, Henry, Uncharted, especially the second game onward, is like, you're playing a movie.
Yeah.
And then seeing a trailer for the movie that depicts a level in the game, like, remember when he was falling out of the plane, had to climb up? Well, now you can watch it. It's like, well, I was playing it before and that was echoing a movie, I don't know, 12 years ago, 13 years ago. It just seems so tedious and redundant.
And it's less fun watching Holland do it than me playing it as me, the most important character. Yeah.
It's infuriating because nobody seems to really comment on that phenomenon, really. And I haven't seen that many movies. I think the movie Gamer, which is not very good, but is at least trying to talk about that.
Yeah.
I would argue Scott Pilgrim versus the World is trying to play with that a little bit in the way that it works with video game imagery. But like for the most part, it's literally just like, no, we just want to have that kinetic, that feeling that the viewer is driving the experience rather than whoever made the movie. Mm-hmm. And like to have that kinetic style, and it just like leads to less and less interesting movies, mm-hmm. to me at least.
Yeah, but hey, maybe we're just old.
Yeah, I think that's part of it.
Yes,
we know too much. We've seen too much. I mean, just to wrap up here, I mean, I feel like this movie just lit the brains on fire of everyone who made a video game in the past, I don't know, 20 years, because the rules of this world feel so video gamey to me, in which it's like it's a confined area. You're there alone. You have to find things as you're going through this environment. Everybody you meet is hostile. Like everybody
you
is
have
an
to
enemy.
Kill everybody. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Without question, everyone will kill you on sight. So like it justifies killing everyone you meet. There are safe zones where you can save your game and meet NPCs like Brain and Maggie.
Yeah. Have branching dialogue. Yeah.
There are these set pieces involving mines. Like there's a big set piece in Metal Gear Solid where you're looking for mines and you know, avoiding mines in this minefield. Like just these set piece ideas, there's a boss fight, just all of these things I think would eventually form the structure of what would be a modern video game. I think it's hard to say it's coincidental when there are so many smoking guns in this movie, that just so many people have drawn so much from this movie.
Yeah, the connection is like one-to-one in so many ways, and it's Kojima is just like the best at copying it and then integrating it into a bigger story and not just copying it. Like there's how many arcade machines litter the world of just like a guy with a gun and an eye patch on it. He's just like, there, that's our main character, gun and eye patch and camouflage. That's it. Like you can take all the surface level stuff of Snake, but Snake Plissken, but Solid Snake has the deeper stuff below the level, below the immediate vision you have of cool guy who kills people.
But no one borrowed those cool shoulder zippers he has.
Ah, those shoulders. Yeah.
Gotta let your shoulders breathe from time to time.
And what about there is that great quote of like Carpenter about Kojima and how he respects him for that.
Yeah, like I'll end on this. The last thing I looked up for this podcast was thinking, well, actionably he could sue over so many things that were taken from him. Why doesn't he sue? I think it's because he respects other creators is a big part of it. But on the record, he said, oh, yeah, Kojima is a nice guy. At least he was always nice to me. So I think they've been in contact with each other because Kojima, I love the guy. He's a big star fucker. He loves hanging out with Guillermo del Toro and all the celebrities he likes, all the creatives he likes. He loves collaborating. And I'm sure there's been some translated like Skype calls with them or something going on there. Because I think the distributor for the movie wanted Carpenter to sue both Konami and, you know, Kojima to an extent because of just the plagiarism. But he was like, no, this guy's cool and I like what he does. So, you know what, Carpenter, I'm you know, thumbs up to you for not being litigious about this stuff.
I don't know what happened. What was the thing with him in Lockout? There was some I know there was a lawsuit, but that's like the only time I've ever heard him actually go too bad about it. Was there was some Lockout, the Guy Pierce,
what's
his name, Fifth Element guy,
Luc Besson,
Luc Besson. There was some that was the one time I've ever heard John Carpenter be like, no, I actually have to sue in this case.
you know, went too far.
Literally just a pure ripoff.
Maybe this was after he became a gamer. He found out about this. It's just like, well, you know what, these games are fun. I'll play them all.
Well, yeah. And Kojima is very respectful of all the direct. Every time I've seen him take so many pictures, even before he just started making them actual actors in his video games, like with Guillermo del Toro, I think, and yeah, what he always wanted to make was movies. Like that's why his video games got more and more movies, cutscenes every single time. And I feel like he should just, you know, his next game should just be a movie. Like forget making a game for it. Though then again, we all. You know, I didn't even love playing Death Stranding all that much, But the joke was on us when he made that story about the brave delivery man who's walked through a hellscape of America split into pieces.
I think that game came out in November of 2019. Yep. So it's like, get ready. 4 months from now, guys, you're going to be living Death Stranding. It's going to be a lot of fun. So, Chris, we're at the end of our time here. Any final thoughts on the movie? And then please let us know where to find you online and all about We Hate Movies. I'm a huge fan. Henry is too.
Oh, yeah.
And you've done a podcast about this movie as well, as you've said up front.
Yeah. It's like I said, Carpenter is a director I come back to a lot. This is one of those that, like, it so immediately was exactly what I was expecting it to be, I think, from what I had heard it was. That, like, at first I didn't even see how great it was. And then I think since coming back to it so many times, I the craft of it and the leanness of it and the refusal to give the audience too much or to oversaturate with information, it shows so much wisdom that movies of, like, you know, that are celebrated by fucking critics groups and awards don't have half of it. And he had it, and he just happened to he's dedicated to genre. He mm-hmm. loves it. And something like this really makes an argument, I think, for people to just make great genre movies and not think of it as so much of a cage, to play with it and to have fun with it. Me and the guys did talk about this in length on our Patreon, patreon.com/wehatemovies. It's a movie. I never get tired of talking about Carpenter. I could literally talk about him all day. I think he's one of the few directors that seems like he is what he presents himself to be. There doesn't seem to be much of a separation. And I hope I'm not proven wrong on that, you know, 10 years from now or whatever. But, you know, for now, it's been very comforting to watch his movies. And even the bad one, like, you know, Village of the Damned is not good, but even to see what he plays with in those movies has been a treat. It's still a treat to me.
And this podcast is coming out at the end of January. I know you're wrapping up your worst of 2021 on We Hit Movies. Can you hint at what's coming up next in February of 2022?
Oh, God. We're going to be doing some 90s, I'm going to say. We've been trying to go back to the 90s more and more. And the Valentine's Day episode will be very special, I'll say.
Excellent.
That is kind of a hint, but not really.
Looking forward to it.
That's awesome.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of Retronauts. You can find us on Twitter as @Retronauts. In case you didn't know, this podcast is completely fan-supported on Patreon. So if you go to patreon.com/retronauts, you can sign up for $3 a month to get all these episodes 1 week at a time and ad-free. Sign up for $5 a month. That is a good tier to be at, folks, because if you do, you get 2 full-length bonus episodes every month, and we've been doing this since the beginning of 2020, so now there's over 100 full-length bonus episodes that you have not heard if you're not on the $5 tier at patreon.com/retronauts. And every week you also get a column and podcast by our contributor Diamond Fight as well at the $5 level. So it's a good place to be if you want to support the show and get extra podcasts for your buck. Again, that is patreon.com/retronauts. And Henry, I have a feeling that we do things too. Lots of podcasts.
We do quite a lot.
I was correct about that.
Yeah, me and Bob do the Talking Simpsons Network of podcasts, starting with Talking Simpsons, our weekly exploration of the entire series of The Simpsons in chronological order. We have had a lot of fun with that. We're just about reaching the end of our re-exploration of season 2 as well as season 12. That means season 3 and season 13 coming your way real soon. And we've had lots of great guests on it, me and Bob, including Chris Cabin, this week's guest, and all the guys from We Hate Movies, as well as tons of other great people. And at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons, you get tons of exclusives for $5 a month. You get to hear a monthly episode of us covering Futurama and King of the Hill, both in the same style that we do this. Plus, we have our What a Cartoon and What a Cartoon Movie podcast, where we cover just about any type of animated series or feature film. Coming very soon is one about Sonic the Hedgehog that I bet you Retronaut listeners would have a really good time listening to. So check it all out at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons or Talking Simpsons wherever you get your podcasts. And you can, of course, follow me on Twitter at HENEREYG.
And I've been your host for this one, Bob Mackey. You can find me on Twitter as @BobServo. And that's it for us this week. We'll see you again very soon for another episode of Retronauts. Thanks for listening.